that we speak a bit about the idea of Musa, what it is, how it's connected to this time of year, what the Musa movement was exactly, what we should be doing about it, or how we should be applying those ideas. I'm going to assume a basic level that there may be some people present who are not entirely familiar with what the whole Musa movement and idea was and is. Is that correct? Others are not sure if they know or don't know. And try and explain a little bit of it at a basic level, as well as try maybe to include some examples to give us an actual tangible feel about what this idea is. Let's start like this. The general idea of the current of Musa, the movement, the energy that's known as the Musa movement within Jewish thinking, is the idea of character building. That means working on your personality as an explicit exercise, right? As opposed to just absorbing the ideas of good character and sort of coming across them by osmosis and through one's Torah learning in particular. There was an idea that became current in the last century, which is now an accepted stream or movement within the Torah world, that one should study these things explicitly and work on them explicitly. That's the general idea. I'll try and explain it in more depth, but that's the general idea. Let's start off by maybe, before we begin to actually take it apart, what is the connection, first of all, with this particular time of year? We've explained before, and we tried to discuss together in depth, the idea of the 49 steps that we go through between Pesach and Shavuos, which means that we understand that there's an opportunity to grow from Pesach, which is sort of a passive experience in a way, through to the human or even transcendent level of Shavuos by working steadily through 49 different stages. The difference between Pesach and what follows, we tried on one or two occasions to bring out in more detail. The difference is that Pesach is a one-time elevation. That means the person is rocketed, if you're sensitive to it. I'm sure there must be seats, you don't have to stand. The difference between that phase, which is a one-time spiritual elevation, and this, which is a gradual, many-step process, we tried to look at in detail that the first one is sort of a free experience that you can lock into and be elevated, whereas now you have the experience that means you have to work in small steps, making a kinyan, that means an acquisition on each step. There are no free gifts in this period. We try to point out that the period of Pesach is a free gift in that you get elevated if you want to without having to do any work. The problem is you have to pay the price afterwards of trying to make that a meaningful acquisition by retracing your steps, having been inspired and seeing what you could get to, through the 49 days that are 49 stages, really, of spiritual battle, let's say. The beautiful, I think there's a book called Sefer Azmanim. The author there is a beautiful marshal. He says that it's like Pesach and Sfira is like a father and son who are walking in a very dangerous place. And while they were walking in this very dangerous place, they came across a chest of treasure. So when they saw the treasure chest, the son wanted to start going through the jewels in detail to see what they had. And the father, who was wiser, said to him, let's take the chest and get out of this place, which is dangerous, and later, when we're safe, we can go through it in detail. And they say, that's the Pesach experience. You're at an unusual pitch of spiritual tension, but there's no time then to start going through what you've gained, and you'll lose it if you start taking it apart. You have to take it as a total experience. That experience of uplift, as we said before, like the beginning of a marriage or the beginning of a friendship or the beginning of any experience, is much more powerful than any other stage. But of course, it's an illusion, because you actually haven't put effort into it yet, and it's only after years of working at that thing that you could get back to some of the inspiration that you might have felt in the beginning, but this time meaningfully, because you actually built it. That's the idea. So what we're going through, relative to the Pesach experience now, is the experience of trying to build ourselves in those detailed steps. And we tried on previous occasions to actually speak out a little bit, what are those steps? What are the 7 weeks and why 7 times 7? Tonight is the third of the third, the third day of the third week, which is the point of complete balance within complete balance. Very unusual, very unique time today, tonight and tomorrow. A person should strive for perfect harmony. Try and imbue the neshama with that force today because of special power that's available that you could use to do that. But it's only one of 49 different stages, each of which is critically important. The link, the chain, can't be built without every single link. Now, the idea of the Muslim movement was that this study, there should be an explicit study of these ideas. That means a person should explicitly take off time, put in time, to study each of these details in such a way that it becomes clear to you and becomes an inalienable part of your personality. Let's see if we can try and trace a little bit the history, just briefly without too much detail, of what exactly happened, how this came to be, what was the argument about it at the time, and what are we left with from that whole period. Let me say this, though, as an introduction, that we can't cover the subject of the history of this idea thoroughly tonight, and we certainly can't cover the whole of the depth of what it means tonight. And for that reason, you refer to some excellent books and tapes on the subject. Excellent tapes would be Rabbi Beryl Wine series, where he deals with the Muslim movement in a very dramatic and unforgettable way, and some of the characters and personalities of the movement. And there are many good books. I would recommend a book called Sparks of Musa and a book called The Fire Within. I'm sure you can get them at the new Osama bookshop, where they'll probably give you a cup of coffee as well. Other places too. And you can pick up much more detail. And the whole essence of Musa is that it takes concentrated study. You can't just hear it once. You need to batter down the resistance and what's called the negias, the vested interest in the personality. It's a very hard work of having to batter away constantly and try to get these ideas to drive into the personality so that you actually acknowledge their truth. Recognizing their truth, as we discussed a little bit a week ago, 2 weeks ago, recognizing the truth is one thing, but letting it actually drive into your personality so you actually live that way is a completely different thing. The work of Musa was twofold. It was to recognize the truth of the need for character building and the details and anatomy of what character building is and where the difficulties are, and then the harder work of driving it home into the personality. The Ramchal wrote a wonderful book. This actually is his classic, which just happens to be here. This is his classic on, and glad to see well used, classic on the 10 stages of spiritual perfection leading up to complete transcendence, almost prophetic ability. In case you get carried away with it, you should know that most greats hold that we're not relevant to us anymore beyond the second or third chapter of the 10. But believe me, you get to the second or third chapter of this, having internalized it, then that would be equivalent to much greater things. Of course, we study the whole work, but we have to know that there are limits in this generation, relatively speaking. He wrote a book called Das Tunis, which is devoted to the work, such a beautiful and wonderful subject. This whole idea of trying to touch on as many points as I can this evening just by way of general introduction is a book in which he deals with the problem of recognizing truth and then getting it into the personality. The way he puts it is that you have to recognize it, as it were, with the mind, but then you have to drive it into the heart. And actually the book is a wonderful device. The book is phrased as a conversation between the mind and the heart. There's a male being called the mind and a female being called the heart, and he speaks to her all the time and she asks him questions. And he teaches her, the two of them work out together, how to take the truths that can be recognized by the intellect and actually drive them into the neshama, into the heart, into the inner core of the emotions and deeper, so that a person actually becomes those things. That's the hard part. Let's try and trace the movement in very sketchy outline without going into that, more than one or two of the characters who were involved, and see exactly what happened. The way to begin the discussion is that the founder of the Muslim movement, the so-called founder of the Muslim movement, was known as Rabbi Saul Salanta from Salant, who lived in the last century. I think he was born in about 1810, and he died in 1883, something like that. He was a person who founded a new movement, but the important thing to understand for us is that there was nothing new about the movement at all. The only detail that you could call new is that he put it into a situation where people began to appreciate that you had to take it as something that had to be done explicitly. Until that time, the main object of Torah study and religious development, spiritual development, was definitely the result that took place in your personality, was the refinement, the spiritual change that happened to a person's personality. But the idea previously was that people were sensitive enough through living in a Torah environment, studying Torah the way it should be, that the effect happened automatically on your personality.
Or at least you got the message of how to work on yourself without having to sit down and study it explicitly. In fact, the beginning of the Muslim movement was a very interesting debate between the two greats of this particular issue, which was the Shah Salat on the one hand and the Brisk school on the other hand, who felt that it was unnecessary to do this thing explicitly, and it was an admission of defeat to have to do it explicitly. Try to explain that. So let's understand the thing details one at a time. The first point is this, that there is nothing new about the essential idea of working on oneself as a more sensitive and refined human being. There's no question, everybody agrees, that's the underpinning, it's the basis of Torah. The point, anybody would study Torah academically and not have any change in his personality, that would be considered completely invalid, exactly the opposite of what you should be doing. There's no question about that. And you'll see people are very sensitive to it. You'll often find people pick out and point fingers at certain so-called religious individuals because they seem to be doing the outer things correctly, but people are sensitive to the fact that they're not doing the inner things correctly. Of course, the important thing to be doing is the inner thing. You can exchange the uniform if necessary. The outer uniform is necessary if you've got the inner things right. But of course, the easy thing to do is to get the uniform right and not get the inner content. That's very, very easy, and that, in fact, is one of the prime targets of the Muslim movement, is to try and show up the inconsistency of those two worlds and make it clear, and then enable you to actually have the strength to put the two together. So when Rousseau came along and started teaching the idea that instead of just learning Torah and learning Gemara, we have to now sit down and actually study the subject of working on ourselves and do it explicitly and teach ourselves the principles, extract them from the Torah sources, teach them explicitly, and then go out and practice them in the world, and they used to practice them diligently to an unbelievable degree, there was objection on the part of a lot of Torah institutions and personalities who felt that that wasn't the traditional way, and if Jews had managed without doing it that way for so long, then it surely wasn't necessary. If we produced the greats that we produced in terms of human depth and sensitivity and refinement without having to do it explicitly, why do it explicitly? And basically the argument boiled down to an agreement, famous conversation is quoted between the Brisker Rodman and Rousseau Salanta. The argument boiled down to the understanding that everybody agrees, the way Rousseau put it was, that previously we were able to do it automatically. That means you were able to learn Torah and you got it automatically. By the way, women used to get it just by absorbing it from their mothers. The tradition in Jewish life was that a man needed to sit in yeshiva and drum it into his head, but women had the sensitivity and to absorb it from their mothers, from the home, and Jewish mothers had the greatness to instill it in their daughters without needing a formal course of tuition in it. It's a remarkable thing. That's a tradition that goes back to the Imams. And the famous beginning of the Beis Yaakov movement, the turn of the century, whenever it was that we now need a yeshiva system, as it were, for girls, for women, to be able to study the Torah that they need to study in the framework of yeshiva. And people hailed it as a great thing, but people who know that it in fact was an admission of defeat in a sense. Because it means that no longer could the Jewish home provide that unadulterated power that a woman could absorb from her mother, going back to the beginning of the chain, that now we need a formal institution to do it, which is necessary, and it was done in response to the need, but not what the power had been before. Men have always needed to absorb it, both in that framework from parents and home, and also by the institution of yeshiva grappling with the Gemara and battling away at it with Torah until a change takes place in the mind and the personality. The point was that Rousseau made that the Jewish world came to a point, I'm not going to go over the details of this idea, I'm sure you're familiar with it, that we have been going down in each successive generation. You're probably familiar with that. It's called Yeridas HaDoros, that each era of generations, each group of generations in Jewish history has got further and further from the source, and therefore the voltage drops in an exponential way. We now reach a point where the spark of energy, the transmission of the idealism of Torah and its effect on the personality is now so faint that we have to start treating the patient, as it were, with intensive care. I mean, before the patient could absorb it, the person could absorb it in a healthy way, now we have to feed it to him in the way that a sick person needs. Yes? In other words, he can't eat a healthy diet anymore. A normal healthy diet would be totally the way it always used to be learned and taught. Now the patient is too sick to absorb that diet. That means a person could sit and learn Torah. The world came to a situation where you could have a person studying Torah sincerely in a yeshiva environment with all the right elements and still not necessarily refine his personality to the required degree. So we saw the idea was that since the patient has become sick to that degree, you change the diet. If a person can't eat a normal diet, you might have to soften the diet so that he can nurse himself back to health. And the other side of the argument was that we agree that the patient is sick, but we feel that feeding him that kind of a diet will just lower the whole level to that stage and that'll be that. The patient will recover but able only to eat liquids instead of being able to digest what he should be digesting. So let's rather try and strengthen him to be able to eat a normal diet. You follow? That was the argument. Do we strengthen the Jewish world to the point that they can eat a normal diet now and learn Torah the way it had to be and dispense with this whole idea of consciously working on our personalities? Or do we admit that we're not capable of doing that, and do we mash the diet, yes, and digest it and make it explicit and lower its voltage, as it were, so that it can be digested? The price you pay is that you admit a lower level. The price you pay on the other side is that the patient might not digest the diet. Are we together? The view that held sway, generally speaking, it was a massive discussion and debate for a lengthy, long period of time. The view that, generally speaking, won the day was that we are badly in need of intensive care and of highly modified diet. Therefore, most yeshivas in the world, not all, but most yeshivas today, do set aside time for Musa study as an explicit end in itself. In most yeshivas, it's 20 minutes a day or half an hour out of the whole curriculum, which is still a very small fraction, but it's enough to conscientize, if you want to use that word, to energize the circuits of awareness that this needs to be done. And of course, half an hour of study might well be enough to trigger the exercises that a person needs to do to go out and practice some of the Musa techniques. Rishon himself was a person who taught Musa in a most amazing way. He taught it explicitly as a teacher, and he taught it as a human being. The stories about him are legend, and you should definitely read books, many books about him, to pick up the sensitivity and the genius of the person involved. Let me start maybe with an example that most people don't know. Remarkable thing. Unbelievable thing. I was once discussing, he had an unbelievable effect on Lithuanian Jews. He worked in Germany also, died there in fact, but he had an unbelievable effect on Lithuanian Jews. This effect is closer to your heart than you may know. Once I was discussing the subject of South Africans with the great Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael, I think that doesn't exist. And I said to him, we were discussing the fact he was observing, the two of us were observing, what unusual people South Africans are. And I can say it. Right? And that is that we are still a community that has a remarkable degree of homogeneous subscribing to Torah values. Yes, despite the fact, as I understand as well, it's a long discussion in its own right, but the fact remains, and people from all over the world will tell you how struck they are when they see the South African, we have contact with the South African Jewish community, you hear it in the Torah world, you hear it outside the Torah world, within the Jewish world, that they perceive South Africans as people who have a remarkable sensitivity to the question, to the idea of being a mensch. Yet, you'll see it manifest itself in the fact that, while this generation, my generation, one and two generations before us, let's say, may have come from Lithuania and may have dropped the idea of Torah observance, of mitzvah observance in its particular manifestation, and they may have dropped the idea of Torah learning as an end in itself, but dropping the idea of being a mensch, they certainly didn't do. Any South African who knows anything, if you think about it, you'll realize that your parents, and if not your parents, certainly your grandparents, were the kind of individuals who, while they probably were not observant in the formal sense, probably put all of us in the shade significantly in terms of human values, in terms of Jewish values. That means in terms of commitment to ideals, in terms of your word being your bond, in terms of the concept of integrity, the concept of responsibility, sacrifice for children, the fact that responsibility came first, in terms of certain elements of dignity and modesty. I mean, certain refinements. I mean, there's so many things. A person of that generation in business, for example, everybody knows. Jews of that generation, if a person said something, you didn't have to even shake hands. You know that if he said it, you knew if he said it, it wouldn't change. Today, a signature on a contract is irrelevant because the person doesn't mean it when he says it or even signs it at all. There's no concept of loyalty or responsibility left anymore. That generation was based on those ideas. And we were discussing the subject that the South African Jewish community, and it's filtered down to this generation, unfortunately is going rapidly, disappearing rapidly. The truth is that if you compare this generation of youth to one generation before, and you compare that to the one before it, you'll see an exponential and frightening drop in Jewish and human values in the Jewish community in this country, no question about it. The rate of intermarriage, the divorce rate, the way business dealings are done, sense of responsibility and dignity in the youth, mental stability, you'll see that these things are diving exponentially. And despite that, you'll see that young Jews of this generation are still relatively normal compared to many, I don't want to point out other places, but in many other places in the, let's say, Western Hemisphere, where the youth, can hardly be considered to be normal, and certainly hardly can be considered to be Jewish. The rate of intermarriage in certain other places, although we are unfortunately accelerating in that issue in a disastrous fashion, still we don't come close to certain other places where things are much worse. And that was the gist of the conversation. And he said a remarkable thing to me that I'll never forget. He said, yes, and it's all due to Rabbi Saul. You hear that? Rabbi Saul Salanter, that great teacher, lived in the 1800s in Europe. to spend time in Lithuania, spend time in Vilna, and later moved to Germany. His teachings had such an impact. You hear this unbelievable thing? You have to be that great to be able to say it. He said that his influence on the world, one man, his influence, his teachings, had such an effect that the South African Jewish community, to this day, can boast the level of relative normality that we have, and certainly in a generation or two beyond before us, much more than normality, greatness in terms of commitment and all the things I mentioned. He attributed to the fact of what this man had put into work. And I understood afterwards what he meant. What he meant was, what did Rishol do? He came to teach values of working on yourself as a human being, of being a mensch. The new thing that he put in, you follow? The new thing that he put into us, into our consciousness, was not sitting and learning Torah, which was the Jewish world had until then. He put in the concept of working on yourself explicitly to be a mensch. What happened in South Africa? The idea of learning Torah as an end in itself had dropped out, but being a mensch remained. And he attributed, yes, and anybody, just think back and think of your parents or grandparents speaking to you about the disdain that they had for people who didn't behave like a mensch. Right? And somebody who, just that, and everything that they meant with it, all the richness of association that they meant by such a thing, that you understood so richly and so well. Remarkable to think that at least in the mind of one genius, it was attributable to one particular individual. It's a remarkable thing. Other things that are relevant now that the South African Jewish community, particularly the homogeneous community, almost all of us Lithuanians, a lot of identity and uniformity between us, many other things also that go into the mix that could produce this result. Not tonight, subject. How did he teach it? He perceived from the age when he was a very young man, he perceived that this was the problem. That if people were left to their own devices to continue learning in a religious environment and learn Torah without being imbued specifically and fired up and inspired with the idea of working on yourself and taking as your ultimate project in life your own personality, if you don't focus on that and make a goal of it, that everything you do should be explicitly fed in to what you're becoming as a human being, and to perverting, if you want to use that word, to reforming the battle in your mind between the tendency of the negative side of your personality, Yetzer Hara, to overreach itself and to swamp the positive side. Unless you redress that balance in a conscious fashion, he felt it wouldn't be done. And therefore he set about teaching these things in an explicit way, and himself, perhaps more eloquently than what he said, became a personality, was a personality, who taught these things in a remarkable way. There's unbelievable stories that are told about how he actually went about doing this. First of all, the many things that he taught have come down to us, classic things that he said, classic things, a genius of an ability to be able to put a fine touch to a situation in such a way that the right result would come out of it and no transgressions would take place. Let me give you an example. Just understand a little subtlety of wisdom and depth that a person can, with conscious effort and development, that a person could reach. I'm trying to tell you a few stories that come into my head. Once it happened that people from Kovna came to Rishol and they said to him the following thing. They said to him, it's a long and complicated, the details and the ramifications of the story are complex and interesting, try and make it simple. He said, they told him that in Kovna there was a man who was a tzaddik nista. Tzaddik nista means a hidden tzaddik. A saintly individual of unbelievable level and abilities who was completely hidden and no one knew about him. How did they know? Because the people who reported the story said that they happened to be close to this man who was working as a menial laborer in a factory somewhere in Kovna. But as they got close, they heard that under his breath, he was rapidly reciting the Talmud Yerushalmi by heart. Okay? This man was revising completely by heart all of the Talmud Yerushalmi flawlessly. Now, you know that nobody even looks at Talmud Yerushalmi until they know the Talmud Bavli absolutely backwards. Nobody, you follow, the Talmud Bavli definitely is what we learn as a priority. So nobody would know the Talmud Yerushalmi by heart until he knew many, many other things by heart. And it's a remarkable achievement, unbelievable achievement. But they said that when they approached this man and asked him questions about himself and he realized he'd been overheard, he denied it. He said he didn't know what they were talking about and they must have made a mistake and he was a simple laborer and why were they bothering him? So they went to his soul and we can't afford to let a man like this remain hidden. This man is pretending that he hasn't reached this great level, and actually he must be one of the few of the generation. Now what did Rabbi Saul answer? You may put yourself in his situation for a moment. You can't say Lashon Hara, right? You can't say something negative or insulting about anybody. On the other hand, you must say things that are true, and yet you have to take into account this particular individual's feelings. You have to take into account the fact of his greatness, and that presumably if he's at that level, he must have some kind of reason for doing this. You follow? There are many things that you have to achieve when you're faced with such a question. Let me tell you his answer and see if you can identify what was going on. Rosh Hashanah answered them like this. He said this: you say that there's a man in Kovna, the Tzadik Nisra, and you tell me the story about him. He said this: I very much doubt it. He's probably making a mistake. Probably it's a mistake. Probably you imagined it and the story's got out of proportion. It's a big mistake. Why? I'll tell you why. Because we're in a generation now where we can't afford to have anybody remain hidden. We're such a lowly generation. We so desperately need Torah teachers. This generation, its prime deficit, let's say, is enough people of Torah greatness who can actually teach. In fact, the Chazmish once said that you're not free not to teach Torah. You're no longer allowed to say that I can't teach Torah because who am I? The Chazmish said it would be like a soldier saying that he's lame and he's got an injured arm. How can he fight? When the fight is to the death, yes, and it's fight or die, then even the cripples have to get out on the battlefield to do their best. That's what the Chazmish said. So Rishol said the same thing. He said like this: that this generation we can't afford. If a person's that great, he would know that he can't remain hidden. You hear this? If he's as great as you say, he would know that he can't remain hidden. In other words, it's not possible for a man to be that great and still choose to remain hidden because the need is so great. But if he is so great and he is remaining hidden, he must know what he's doing. Leave him alone. Yeah, in one fell swoop, you hear what he did? He protected the man's cover. He took the heat off him. He said true. He taught a fantastic Torah principle. You hear what's going on without saying anything negative about anybody? Well, that's a challenge. Most people, as you're quite aware, only open their mouth to change feet, as they say. No. And I stand the degree of foresight and control that goes into such a thing. He was famous for teaching the priority of putting people first in an environment where you usually tend to think the other way around. For example, he used to say that how should you be careful when you put on your talus? You know, when you put your talus on in the morning, you're supposed to put it over your head, then you wrap all four corners and you fling them over your shoulder as you make the bracha, and then you put your spoon. So he used to speak sharply about people who would do this, and while they're busy doing this, they're flicking someone in the eye, yes, who's standing behind them in shul with the threads of their talus, he can't see for the rest of the day. So the person thinks that he's very big tzaddik. You see the way he's doing this whole elaborate thing. Meantime, he's behaving in a way that's a degradation of what he is as a human being. But the thing is, people are sensitive to those things. And he was famous for that kind of thing. It happened once on Pesach. They came to Israel just before Pesach when they were baking matzahs. And you know, matzah baking, we discussed it a little bit a few weeks ago, the idea of matzah and its the urgency of baking it in the required amount of time. There was the problem of how to bake the matzahs in such a way that all the details would be observed correctly, and it's a very tense time. If you've ever been in a yeshiva, when the yeshiva we had, you know, Samach used to have the privilege, the yeshiva used to take over a bakery. We used to go into Meir Shearim and take over the whole bakery and bake matzah. It's the most amazing experience. But it's done in a spirit of unbelievable, larger-than-life reality, because you have to move from the beginning of the process at one end of the bakery until the matzah is baked must be less than 18 minutes. So the water and flour have to be mixed and kneaded, and all the rollers... it's an amazing process that happens in absolute concert, and everybody's saying the shame matzah's mitzvah, and you have to keep your attention that it's for the sake of matzahs as a mitzvah. It's a remarkable thing that has to be done with great speed and alacrity. So people gear up for it, and it's... So they came to Yisrael and they said, teach us, Rebbe, what should we be careful of? Right? What exactly should we focus on? How should we be careful when we go about to undertake this matter? They were listening for the great. So he said to them, the thing you should be very careful of is don't forget that part of the process, in that bakery yard, there's a widow who's a sensitive woman. Don't rush her. Yeah, that's what you should be thinking of. Because if you bake the matzahs and you put all these idurim into it, it'll all be fine. And a woman will be broken hearted because you insulted her, because she isn't fast enough, the matzahs aren't worth it. You see, the thing is that not only is the sensitivity and the chiddush, but of course we try to think the other way. We always think the wrong way around. You know, as they say, we think of our own gashmias and somebody else's rukhnias. You know, that's the tendency. The Yetzer Hara tends always to invert what you should be thinking. We think of our own gashmias, our own physicality, and we're very concerned about our own comfort physically, and very concerned that everybody else should do right spiritually. They should live up to their spiritual obligations. But of course, that's not the way it is. The Muslim view is that you worry about your own spirituality, and you worry about his gashmis, you make him comfortable. You worry about that person and take care of his physical needs, and you worry about your own spiritual responsibilities. But of course, we don't do it that way. There are many, many versions of it, the Balei Musa always pointing out.